It's based on a recent, sort of recent paper with Herman Verlinde and Matt Guekan, another graduate student at Princeton. And the plan of the talk will be somewhat standard introduction with the motivations for the ISS, for the SUSY braking in a hidden sector. Then I'll explain why the ISS model might be a good choice to study the SUSY braking in the hidden sector and the stringy interpretations of SUSY braking. Then this will be the most part of my talk. And towards the end of the talk, I will talk a little bit on the problems that I'm working on now. And this is the R-symmetry problem, because in the ISS model, the R-symmetry is unbroken, but we still need to break the R-symmetry to get a good spectrum of masses in the visible sector. And I'll have some conclusions in the end. So there are some references that I put here. This is our paper. And most of the talk will be based on this paper. And this is a very close paper. It appeared the same month, basically. And like within a month. Then this is the first ISS paper, and this is where I get my inspiration for the SUSY braking. These are the papers where I got my inspiration for the geometry, for the stringy interpretation of this SUSY braking, and this is where I get my inspiration for the phenomenology. And so let me proceed with the introduction. It's known that the supersymmetry is quite good for solving some problems, such as the hierarchy problem. But since our world is not supersymmetric, we still need to break it. And if we introduce, for example, soft terms by hands in the visible sector, we still need to explain why the soft terms are much smaller than the Planck scale. So this doesn't really solve the problem of the hierarchy. If we try to find some spontaneous SUSY braking in the visible sector, then due to the vanishing supertrace of mass squared, there usually exist some very light supersymmetric partners that we don't observe. So the spontaneous braking at the tree level also doesn't usually work. But if we break the supersymmetry spontaneously in some hidden sector, and we mediate the masses for the super partners in the visible sector through some loops of the mediator fields, then this gives some sensible results. And the usual scheme is that there's some supersymmetric extension of the standard model, there's some mediating sector, and there's some hidden, secluded, and some other synonyms sector where we have the SUSY braking. And in the string theory, there were a lot of attempts to build some supersymmetric extensions of the standard model, but there haven't been much work done on the models where we have also the supersymmetry breaking. And this work has started maybe 2 years ago with a series of different papers, and he will present why I think ISS model is a good candidate to study the supersymmetry breaking in string theory. And some of the reasons is that there exists both a good field theoretic description, which sometimes lacks in some stringy constructions, and as I will show, there exists a good geometrical interpretation of various features of the ISS model. So we can have two sides of the picture. And what is probably most important, it's also quite generic in field theory and string theory. What I mean generic in field theory is that the supersymmetry breaking in the metastable vacuum is more generic than the supersymmetry breaking in a completely stable vacuum due to some theorems. And like an example of a theorem that will tell that supersymmetry vacuum metastable vacuum is more generic, for example, the Nelson-Zeiber theorem, is that to break the supersymmetry for a generic superpotential, we need the R symmetry. Right? So we need some symmetry that leads to more equations than we have fields to satisfy these equations, more F-term equations than we have fields due to the symmetry. But we need to break R symmetry to generate the masses for the Gay genus. I will return to this point a little later, but since we need to break the R symmetry, we usually need to introduce some explicit R symmetry breaking in the superpotential. So in the original formulation, they said that if we break it spontaneously, we can do it without destabilizing the vacuum. But usually it doesn't work and we need to break it a little bit explicitly. If we break it a little bit explicitly, we introduce a supersymmetric vacuum somewhere else in the field space. So the supersymmetric vacuum will be global vacuum and the SUSY breaking vacuum will be only local metastable vacuum. Okay. I will return to that point a little later, but and what I mean generic and string theory is actually I'm trying to explain here is that the geometry that leads to some ISS like vacuum is quite easy to engineer, and I believe it exists in many quiver gauge theories. We just need to find the particular range of parameters where this is possible. And let me first tell you the final result, and I will explain it gradually during the talk. So the geometry that we need to get the ISS SUSY breaking vacuum is that the background Calabi-Yau manifold has some non-isolated singularity passing through some isolated singularity. So let me draw a little picture. We have a non-isolated singularity such as the line of C2 mod Z2 orbifold singularities. And then this singularity is enhanced to a larger singularity at some point. And in fact, we need to slightly deform the non-isolated singularity so that the geometry will be a slightly deformed non-isolated singularity that is enhanced at some point to a bigger isolated singularity, a point-like singularity. And then we put some number of fractional brains in this Calabi-Yau geometry. So the geometry itself is supersymmetric. But a particular combination of fractional brains will lead to a non-supersymmetric minimum in this geometry. And there will be some number of fractional brains wrapping hidden cycles in the isolated singularity and some number of fractional brains wrapping the slightly deformed non-isolated singularity. And the vacuum energy will actually come from the tension of this brains that wrap the non-isolated deformed singularity. Okay. The questions about the geometry so far? So the first maybe intuitive motivation why we look at the geometry that has both non-isolated singularity and isolated singularities. If we just look at the field contents of the ISS model, so the ISS model has a gauge group and a flavor group in the original formulation. What we will do, we just consider this group to be a gauge group with a very small coupling constant. So we consider the slightly gauged ISS model. And then on top of these two gauge groups, there are two bifundamental fields, phi and phi tilde, and one adjoint field in the slightly gauged flavor group. Now, if we think about the geometry and the fractional brain representation of this Cuvier gauge theory, then this node resembles the fractional brains on the non-isolated singularity. For example, if we think about the C2 mod Z2 quiver, the presence of the adjoint fields corresponds to the motion of the fractional brains along the non-isolated singularity, right? And the node without the adjoint field corresponds to fractional brains on the isolated singularities. So in the particular example of the conifold quiver, the cycles are actually the same cycles from as in the C2 mod Z2 quiver, but the cycles have changing size. So they're zero only at one particular point at the conifold singularity. And we don't have a translational mode in the direction of non-isolated singularity. That's why we don't have the adjoint fields here. So these fields are massive in the conifold, and we integrate them out to find the conifold field theory. So this is kind of intuitive motivation why we at all consider this kind of geometry. And to be a little bit more explicit, let me remind ourselves the superpotential for the ISS model. It has a Yukawa coupling between the adjoint field and two bifundamental fields. And it has an F-term for the adjoint field. And the supersymmetry is broken if the adjoint field has a bigger size than the bifundamental fields. So if NF is bigger than N, then the F-term equations for the adjoint field that look like this cannot be satisfied, because by the rank condition, the rank of the matrix on the left is not bigger than N. And the rank of the matrix on the right is NF. So we have some F-term equations that are not satisfied, and the supersymmetry is broken in this case. And so we see that the supersymmetry is basically broken due to the presence of this F-term for the adjoint field. And how we interpret the F-term for the adjoint field is actually we interpret it as a size of the deformation of the non-isolated singularity. This idea is, of course, not new, and I think the first paper where this idea was derived is the Douglas and Moore paper on the ALE, the resolution of ALE singularities, where they found that F-term and D-term equations with non-zero FI parameter and non-zero F-term parameter can be interpreted as the deformation and the resolution of the corresponding ALE singularities. And for example, I will use this intuition for a more realistic problem. So let me draw a little picture. So if this is the C2 mod Z2 singularity, times C1. So this is the direction of the C1, and perpendicular is the direction of C2 mod Z2 singularity. The D3 brain at this singularity splits into two fractional brains that have D3 brain charge. Let's say this has a D3 brain charge and some D5 brain charge, and the other one has minus the D5 brain charge. So if we deform this singularity, what happens to the fractional brains is that they recombine into D3 brains. So the two D5 charges are oriented in a different direction. And since we have some tension for the D5 component, if we increase the cycle, the size of the cycle where this D5 brain wraps, we increase the energy of this brain. So the, in order to reduce the energy, these two brains recombine into a D5. So they recombine, basically. This have D3 and D5 charge, and in the end they just recombine into the original D3 brain that moves in the smooth deformed geometry. Okay. But if we imagine just hypothetically that we split these two fractional brains apart from each other and we keep them at some finite distance, as we deform the singularity, we increase the volume of the D5 brain component, and this increase in the energy will actually give a vacuum energy in the field theory.
What is controlling the size of the cycle?
The size of the cycle is, suppose we introduce the F term deformation of the superpotential, then the size of the cycle will be proportional to the F term parameter.
So from the gravity perspective, there's some flux, background flux.
Right. You see, you can think about this problem as a problem of, suppose we have some fluxes and want to find the geometry that kind of minimizes the Gukov of a Witten superpotential. So if we find some flux so that the superpotential is minimized for the final size of this cycle, I guess that's what happens. What's the notation? So this is like F3 plus H3. There's a tau somewhere. Maybe here. So if there is some flux of, so this is dC2 and this is dB2. That was the flux, right? No, it's Now, this is just like this. It's one of the standard ways to find the size of the cycle in the background of the fields. Right? So, in this case, if we keep them at some finite distance, we evidently have a supersymmetry breaking. But the problem is that we still need to have some hands that keep them at a finite distance, because if we let them go, they will tend to move towards each other to reduce their energy, and then they just recombine into D3 brains. So what we will do is, actually we will, let me draw a picture here. have only one type of fractional brains that traps the non-isolated singularity that is slightly deformed. If we don't have anything else in the geometry, then actually, in this case, we still preserve the supersymmetry because, like, the geometry breaks the supersymmetry, I don't know, to n equals 2, and then one type of fractional brains breaks it to n equals 1. But if we have some fractional brains that have also some cycles in the isolated singularity, then we break the supersymmetry completely. And also, we will need this extra brains here because they will correspond to this gauge group. And if we have these brains, we also have the bifundamental fields, and that will be necessary for the stabilization of the vacuum. So the vacuum is stabilized at one loop where we compute the superpotential, one loop superpotential, including the loops of this bifundamental fields. Okay. And probably the simplest example of this kind of situation is the so-called suspended pinch point singularity. So this singularity, for non-zero B, it has a C2 mod Z2 singularity along the non-zero B line. And it is enhanced to a stronger singularity at B equals 0. And the stronger singularity can be interpreted as the double canifold point. Because if we deform the C2 mod Z2 singularity by introducing some parameter zeta, then at B equals 0, we have two canifold singularities. So deforming the non-isolated singularity, we get two conifolds in the end at A equals 0 and A equals zeta. Right. So the quiver gauge theory for this singularity looks like this, and I've taken this quiver gauge theory from the Morrison-Plesser paper. And if we just add some suitable fractional brains to this geometry, then we get the ISS quiver. Right? So in this way, it looks like a little bit of cheating, but in the paper, we also computed one step of duality cascade to a quiver that has all three nodes and that cascades down to this ISS quiver from a full SPP quiver gauge theory. So that's for the field content, and let's describe a little the superpotential of this model. The full superpotential for the SPP, for the G3 brains at the SPP singularity looks like this. There's a joint field, there are a bunch of bifundamental fields, and there are Yukawa couplings between a joint and these two pairs of bifundamentals and some quartic couplings.
Sorry, but just yeah. A tilde is a transpose.
It's a new field.
Sorry?
It's an independent field. Yes. It just has opposite charges with respect to the gauge groups. And if we add this fractional brains, then we actually are left with the Yukawa coupling, but we still don't have the F term. And we can get the F term by deforming the C2 mod Z2 singularity within the SPP. And here's some kind of derivation why, in the case of SPP singularity, the F-term deformation corresponds to adding some F-term, and plus there will be actually a mass term for this fields in the full theory, but in our reduced theory, this term will not be important. And I think that the kind of relation between the field theory and the geometry is kind of elegant because, for example, in this case, before we deform the singularity, the way to find the geometry corresponding to the field theory is we just find all the gauge invariant combinations of the fields, then impose some F-term equations and see what constraints satisfy this gauge invariant combinations of the fields. And for the original theory, we have AA tilde, BB tilde, CC tilde, and then ABC and ABC in the other direction. These are the five independent gauge invariant combinations. This gauge invariant combinations satisfy one relation. For example, for the F-term equation for phi field, the relation is AA tilde is equal to BB tilde. And that's what is written here. We have five gauge invariant combinations. There's one constraint. And imposing that constraint, we find that A is equal to A prime. And the product of A, A prime B, is equal to C times D, which becomes the SPP singularity. Now, if we add this term to the superpotential, then the F-term equations for the phi field becomes modified. In this case, AA tilde becomes BB tilde plus zeta, right? So the equation A equals A tilde becomes A equals, or A tilde equals A minus zeta. In this case, A prime is A minus zeta, and that's the equation for the deformed SPP singularity. Okay. And here's the picture for the geometry. So we have, in this case, we have only two types of fractional brains. We have one not empty. These two cycles here correspond to the two conifold singularities that remain after the deformation of the C2 mod Z2 singularity. And this long cylinder here is the deformed C2 mod Z2 singularity. We have fractional brains shaping one of the conifolds. This corresponds to the knot here without the adjoint field. We have some fractional brains that wrap the deformed non-isolated singularity. And this corresponds to the knot here. And then there are some stringed modes between these two fractional brains. And these are the bifundamental fields. So this is the geometry before we go to some vacuum, either supersymmetric or non-supersymmetric. This is the geometry if all the fields have zero vefs. But when we try to solve the F-term equations, some of the fields of this bifundamental fields, phi and phi tilde, will get vefs. So the Suzy breaking vacuum has the following structure. Phi and phi tilde get some vefs mu in order to satisfy the most number, the biggest number of F-term equations. Then these fields become massive. Actually, there is a classically massless combination of the chi fields, but it will actually be massive in the gauged example that I have. And still there is a classically massless field X, the pseudomodulus. So the superpotential in the Susi breaking vacuum has this kind of structure. And the geometric interpretation of this vacuum is that some of the fractional drains on the non-isolated singularity, they combine with the drains on one of the isolated singularities, and they actually become the fractional drains on the second isolated singularity. But still, since we have more drains here than here, there will be NF minus N drains left on the non-isolated singularity that has been slightly deformed. And this NF minus N drains, they correspond to the adjoint X field. So this adjoint X field is the remaining flat direction for this NF minus N drains. And then there are some massive fields, rho and z, that go from this remaining NF minus N drains and the drains on the corner field.
Maybe I should look, but I don't. What do you call a
brain fractional? So what I mean by fractional brain is that usually if there is a singularity and we put some, let's say, D3 brain at the singularity, then near the singularity there will be several different types of brains that look like D3 brain, but they have some additional charges, and these charges correspond to wrapping some hidden or zero size cycles. So although the cycles are zero size, this brain still have the charges corresponding to wrapping these zero size cycles. And I think that was the historical reason to call them fractional. Oh. The word fractional itself means that as we put the D3 brain near the, let's say, singularity, the mass of this various, the masses of the various types of brains that we get become fractional masses of this initial D3 brain charge. For example, if we put a D3 brain on the C2 mod Z2 singularity, in the end we get two types of brains that correspond to wrapping the hidden cycles, and the mass, or the central charge, to be more precise, of these two types of brains will be half the central charge, the absolute value of the central charge of the initial D3 brain. But in this situation, probably the name fractional for the brains that wrap a deformed cycle is not very precise, because it's actually a usual brain. Just maybe sloppy in the a little. And the vacuum energy is actually proportional to the size of this remaining NF minus N drains on the deformed singularity. So the dictionary that we can find in this example is that in the field theory, the F-term deformation corresponds to the deformation of the non-isolated singularity. The waves of bifundamental fields that satisfy the F-term equations correspond to annihilation or recombination of fractional of brains. Then the flat direction for the adjoint X field, the pseudomodular direction, is the motion of NF minus N D brains along the deformed Z2 cycle. And here's the vacuum energy in the field theory, and it's just proportional to the size of the deformed cycle. So it's proportional to the tension of the brains that wrap this deformed cycle. And here's my picture how we can maybe use this example to find the mediation of the supersymmetry breaking to some standard model. Suppose we have a more complicated singularity here, not just a conifold, but some singularity that comes close to the standard model. And we still have this non-isolated singularity with some number of brains wrapping this singularity, and this massive Rho and Z fields can be viewed as the mediators of the Susy break, and this guys here will be the hidden structure, and this conifold in my example can be a model for the standard model. And as soon as we turn to the mediation of the supersymmetry breaking, there's one quite general problem in the F-chum type of supersymmetry breaking is that the R-symmetry is usually unbroken in the Susy breaking vacuum. And the usual way to mediate the or study the gauge mediation of the supersymmetry breaking is to give some mass to the mediator field such that it has somewhat form like this. Here, M is X in our example. So M belongs, may be viewed as a field in the hidden sector that kind of overlaps with the field that breaks the supersymmetry. In our case, this is just the field that breaks the supersymmetry. And so the problem is that in very many cases, this X field has R charge too. For example, in our case, the X field has R charge too, and the phi fields have R charge zero, and the R symmetry is unbroken at the tree level. But if this field has R charge two, then suppose we don't have M here, and we just have theta squared F, the term that breaks the supersymmetry. This F field here has R charge zero, because each of the thetas has R charge one. Which means that if we break the supersymmetry by the F term, we don't break the R symmetry. So the non-zero value for F breaks only supersymmetry and doesn't break the R symmetry. But we need to break the R symmetry because the mass term for the gauge genus breaks the R symmetry. So if we don't break the R symmetry, then we cannot perturbatively give the masses to the gauge genus. And moreover, the R symmetry breaking should be at approximately the same scale as the supersymmetry breaking, because we need the gauge genus masses to be above, let's say, about 100 GeV level, because below that there were some experiments that ruled out the light gauge genus, right, lab 2. So the masses of the gauge genus should be above 100 GeV, but the masses of the squarks should be also in several hundred GeV level in order to avoid some fine tuning in the.
Previous
Previous slide when you refer to Colestino, that referred to the UNF gauge theory, right? To the gauge flavor symmetry.
Yes.
But if you now talk about a gauge geno, now you're talking about UN gauge symmetry, because
yes.
If you would have a gauge geno in the F center, that would be the
problem. Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm right. So I'm talking about the UN or some more general field theory here. So the gauge genus live here. And X breaks the supersymmetry in some hidden sector that is mediated through the loops of
some massive flow in Z fields. Do you have a question also? That's the adjoint field in the hidden sector. And let me just, X couples to the rho and rho fields, like gives some non-trivial mass metrics for rho fields. So this leads to some tension or contradiction in the F type of supersymmetry breaking, because on the one hand, we need to break the R symmetry to generate the masses for the Gaijinos, but on the other hand, we cannot break it too much, because in this case, we just restore the supersymmetry in the hidden sector. But in fact, we can find some clever way to avoid this problem, because spontaneous R symmetry breaking is still possible. It doesn't destabilize the vacuum. And usually what happens is that if we don't have any explicit R symmetry breaking, then the vacuum will still be preserving the R symmetry. But if we break the R symmetry just slightly, then it's actually quite easy to generate a big spontaneous R symmetry breaking, which still doesn't destabilize the vacuum. And let me just give an example of this kind of situation in the theory that we have. So this is the original superpotential for the ISS model. And suppose we add some mass term for the adjoint field with very small M. If we want to preserve the metastability, we need M to be much smaller than mu, so that the supersymmetric vacuum is far, far away from the origin where we have the Susie breaking vacuum and the metastability is not spoiled. Then if we consider the one loop potential for this adjoint field X, it has the usual F term piece plus the one loop mass from the loops of phi and phi tilde fields. This potential for the X field is minimized for X equal to this expression. And an interesting feature of this expression is that X is proportional to M. So if M just goes to zero, then X is minimized for X equals zero. The potential is minimized for X equals zero. But if M is non-zero, we get a non-zero VEF for X, and this VEF can be quite big compared to M, because we have the one loop mass squared in the denominator. So the picture of the potential actually looks like the potential for X is very, very shallow, because this is proportional to the one loop mass of the X field. But if we add a very small mu, we change this potential very, very slightly. But the shift in the position of the minimum can be quite big. And that's what we actually need. We need only X to be big. I call it metastable because, to be more precise, the zero of the potential is not, so the minimum of the potential is not at zero, and this potential actually, far away, it has a zero. So in the ISS story, the zero appears due to some strong dynamics of the SUN gauge theory. In our case, we can just think about the zero of the potential where we have the zero of the F term, and then this actually is not generated at that point far away from the origin. But near the origin, we neglect the dependence of the one loop mass on the VEF of X. So this region here that we consider is up to the scale of supersymmetry breaking mu, and the SUSY is restored at the scale mu squared over m, which is much, much bigger than mu, and slight movements here within mu don't destabilize the vacuum. We still have a stable, locally stable minimum.
Do you have an open string interpretation of this extra green term?
That's what I'm going to talk about now. This is the conclusion. What we have here, small mass deformation leads to a big X VEF. And there is a string theory interpretation of this F term. And let me skip this, actually, and go directly to the interpretation. So this question is actually the question how to, let's say, dynamically generate the various terms in the superpotential from some geometry background, right? And the first question that I'm going actually to answer is how to generate the F-term deformation. And this question was answered in Aganagic Beam Kachru paper, where they, in the ISS section, they basically considered two SPP singularities. So they have the equation like CD equals A squared B, B minus B zero. So this is B equals zero SPP singularity, and this is B equals B zero. Then they put some fractional brains on this, on one of the conifold cycles of the second SPP singularity, for example, between, right, so they just put some cycles on one of the conifolds, and after the geometric transition induced by these brains, the geometry is deformed. So in the usual conifold case, the deformation will be something like this. In this case, they argue that the deformation has this form. You just pick A times B minus B zero and substitute this here. So the corresponding picture would be the following. Then there was a geometric transition here. B equals B zero, and this is B equals zero. We have some geometric transition here, so we replace one of the conifolds here by a three cycle. It corresponds to this kind of change in the geometry, and we see that near B equals zero, we can neglect at first order the dependence on this B compared to B zero for, sorry, B zero is much bigger than one, so we consider them to be very, very far from each other, actually. better way. V0 is much bigger than epsilon to some power. But, okay, so if we consider a very big separation compared to the size of the deformation, then we can neglect the dependence of this geometry on B near B equals 0. And then this equation becomes just the equation for the deformed SPP singularity near B equals 0, right? So if we neglect this dependence, then what we have here is the size of the deformation will be constant. And the size of the deformation corresponds to the size of the FGM deformation, right? So in this case, let's see, the equation on the right-hand side can be rewritten CD equals A, B, and we take B0 out A plus epsilon over B0. Right? Maybe minus. So this is the size of the deformation near the second SPP singularity. And this parameter is the parameter that we have in the Lagrangian, right? So that's the kind of dynamical generation of the F term in the Lagrangian. And this F term actually becomes small, first of all, because the geometric transition here is an example of the conifold transition, right? Where we can have, we can actually have even some cascade from high energy, like Planck scale energy, to quite low energy. And then on top of that, if we prepare the system where these two singularities are separated, we have even bigger reduction of the scale due to the separation. So this can be used as an explanation why the supersymmetry breaking scale is small compared to the Planck scale. And then, right, so this is the dynamical explanation of the F-term. But if we still consider the dependence on the B coordinate here, because in fact the size of the deformation changes a little bit with respect to B. And this actually explains why we get a Suzy restoring vacuum, because if we wrap some brains on these deformed cycles, then they can actually go all the way to the zero. There's an extra zero somewhere in the geometry due to this dependence on the B. But for our purpose, we just consider a small region here. And the dependence of the size of the cycle on B corresponds exactly to the mass term. This can be derived more explicitly using the geometric formulas for the superpotential for the adjoint from the geometry. So they have these formulas with integrating over some cycles. Yeah. But so there's a technical way to find explicitly the dependence. And actually, in their paper, they find that if S is the size of the deformation, this is the Gugino condensate on this second SPP singularity, then the F term that we have found here is just something proportional to S or epsilon over B0. And then the mass term is proportional to S over B0 squared. If the separation is very big, then the mass term becomes much smaller than the F term that can be used to motivate why we think that this mass deformation, first of all, it's present there, and second, it's naturally much smaller than the F term deformation. Okay. Then more questions? Yes. And I think that's the end. I just put some conclusions here. So a few advantages of the stringy ISS construction is that we have some dynamical interpretation of the ISS superpotential in this way. Dynamical, that the geometric transition, that is a dynamical process somewhere else in the geometry, generates the parameters in the superpotential. And there's a rather simple geometrical interpretation of the supersymmetry breaking. And since it's quite easy to imagine that a lot of singularities can be brought to the form where we have some non-isolated singularity passing through some isolated singularity, it might be useful for even phenomenological applications of the ISS model if we find a particular geometry. Yeah, then one can think about the possible ADS-CFT type of extensions of the ISS model. Since we have some geometric interpretation of this model, we can go beyond, or try to go beyond, the weak coupling of the model. And yeah, the work that is still being done by several people and even several groups is the R-symmetry breaking and actually the dynamical R-symmetry breaking. In this case, the R-symmetry breaking seems to be dynamical because we also generate dynamically this M mass deformation. And still we don't fully understand the geometrical proof of the metastability of this vacuum. In the field theory, the metastability comes from the one loop of the small phi fields that generate the mass term for the pseudomodulus, but the geometrical interpretation of that is not yet clear. Thank you. Yes.
You mentioned that you have to slightly gauge, you formulated a slight gauging of the flavor group, right? And you explained that slight gauging means with a small gauge coupling.
Right.
But the only reason in your talk why you gauged it was to give mass to the guy fields. So those
additional.
Is there any other reason why you have to gauge it? Wouldn't a chiral multiplet with just a joint indices do otherwise?
In fact, I guess the easiest way to answer this question is to look at the type 2A dual picture. Like, if we think about the ISS model that has that has the flavor symmetry, that the symmetry is purely flavor, then the gauge group will be represented by NS brains, and the flavor group will be represented by NFD6 brains. In our case, since we have two gauge groups, the picture will be like this. We have N, F, and N, NS5 brains. And if we go to the ideal picture, this NS5 brains correspond to the brains that have some cycles in the geometry. But the geometrical interpretation of purely flavor symmetry is not as clear in the type 2B picture. So if you want it to be like completely purely, completely flavor symmetry, then you know, there are some recent constructions where people try to put some, like, for example, you can put some D7 planes, right, that intersect the singularity, and then an FD7 planes will give you the correct interpretation of the flavor group. But as soon as we put the planes on some cycles, then the corresponding planes have a world volume gauge group on them, which becomes a right. So if you make the cycle infinitely big, then it becomes the like zero coupling gauge group, which is a flavor group. But in some sense, flavor groups are not as like, I guess all the flavor groups in string theory are actually zero coupling gauge groups in this sense. Any more questions? Okay.